a podcast of the cinema.
I wiggled my microphone just then. I wonder if anyone heard it go blah, blah, blah.
You wiggle?
You know what I like about that theme song? And after however many 9 years of having this theme song, or 8 years, how long did we go without a theme song?
We went without a theme song for...
Two or three years?
Several years.
Okay. Yeah. I guess it's been about maybe 7 years that we've had the theme song. Sure. I don't know, like the first couple of years, we just used the cassettes that were on the wall, that are still on the wall.
In the kitchen.
In the kitchen, the cassette wall. I know it's weird. There's cassettes in the kitchen. That's because that's where the cassette player is. Leave me alone. But then came the theme song. And every once in a while, I think about the cool bell sounds that go on in it. Like,
yes.
I play a little air handbell. Go, bung, 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 bung. Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
That's a good theme song.
We do not deserve a straight
theme little,
song.
It's a little upbeat and has always been a little upbeat from my taste. However, I'm happy it exists. It provides a nice counterpoint to... the way I feel inside all the time.
But you always feel better when you hear it, right?
I feel better when I hear it. I feel better when I talk to you, husband.
Well, I hope our listeners feel better when they hear it.
Maybe they do. Listen, people, it's a terrible world out there right now.
Pretty much.
I hope you're inside and not being I hope you're inside and not being near anyone.
Yes.
And if people are near you and they're not wearing a mask, I hope you're yelling at them.
Yes, shame them. And as I always try to mention, that theme song is composed by Blue.
Blue.
B-L-E-U. Very Blue. Talented musician. Very sweet of him to let us have it. Us, by the way, is I'm Alonzo Duraldi.
Sure.
And you're Dave White.
That's also correct.
We host this show.
Yes. We're film critics. We're legally married.
Yes. Legally?
Legally
married?
We're legally married. Legally. 100%.
Sometimes wiggly.
There's no common law marriage going on in this house.
No.
No backwoods shack loving.
Isn't there like some, doesn't some Russ Meyer title have like common law cabin or
something?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. That's kind of where I was going.
There are.
But although for years we did live in the common law cabin because there was no law
to cover.
There was
us
no law to be available to the.
I'm sure there were
the queerest of citizens in the United States.
I'm sure there were urban sophisticates who were also living together as a common law couple. It wasn't just a backwoods shack situation.
Don't erase my culture, okay.
I'm just saying, I don't want to indulge in, you know, stereotypes.
You married a stereotype.
Well, yeah.
we were just talking about this yesterday. Much longer story that does not need to be repeated. Let's just, we come to each other from different worlds.
Yes.
And if you're old enough to know that I just quoted a TV theme song, then you're old.
Good for you.
Yes. What's the deal today? How many movies? We have four?
Four movies.
Four movies to talk about. One is one of the best films of the year.
Yes.
One is one of the worst things I've seen this year.
Yeah. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but it's kind of
one's
a letdown.
One's fine. For what it is, and the other is a fascinating documentary. Let's just discuss the fascinating documentary.
Sure.
From the start, right here and right now.
Yes, yes, yes.
Is there anything else we have to explain to people this week before we begin actually discussing films?
I mean, I think we may be giving somebody a heart attack, and that we're going to start talking about movies within the first 6 minutes of the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You know,
they'll say we've lost our edge.
I think we get a bum rap for being too chatty about non-film things right off the in the first chunk of the show.
Okay.
I mean, sometimes we get right into the movies.
Sure.
Sometimes we get right into the movies at the 30-minute mark.
Yes. Sometimes we don't even introduce ourselves until, like, the 20-minute mark. Who knows?
Listen, I've got some dinner to make. And so it would behoove us.
Oh, there we go.
What?
Well, you're talking about dinner preparation. And now we're back in our comfort
zone. It would behoove us to get this finished.
Okay, fine.
Within the next 65 minutes. Because in 65 minutes, it will be 5:30.
Yes.
Dinner will take me approximately 30 minutes to make.
Okay.
Just from the ground up. It's a quick night. No extensive preparations.
Fair enough.
None of this 3-hour slow roast in the oven nonsense like yesterday.
Exposed in the refrigerator.
You'll hear all about the 3-hour slow roast in the oven nonsense from yesterday on Linoleum Knife and Fork. If you are a subscriber to our Patreon situation, we will talk about that late in the show.
Patreon.com/linoleum.
When it's time for an ad from us, about us, for us, and also for you.
Yes, really, ultimately.
Spaceship Earth.
Yes. From director Matt Wolff, who previously did a documentary we liked quite a bit called Wild Combination.
Yeah.
About composer Arthur Russell.
Is it all over my face?
One of the few people who could be qualified as both an avant-garde composer and a
disco legend,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you have heard Is It All Over My Face, even if you don't know that you have heard Is It All Over My Face. Not only was it a huge disco club hit back in the day, but it has been sampled and sampled and sampled and sampled by other artists.
And it pops up now in a lot of sort of 70s period films and TV shows.
Yeah. I think they've played it even on Pose.
I say, I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like if you're too cool to sort of dip into the Donna Summer well, you know, you unpack Is It All Over My Face to show that
you're... No one is too cool for Donna Summer.
You know what I'm saying.
But there is... I know plenty of friends who are... Yeah, exactly what you're talking about.
If you want to show... Yeah, man, I know the deep...
Yeah, man, Arthur Russell. Yeah, man, I know.
I'm a scholar of disco. Anyway, this film is not about disco. It's... Okay, so... You know that movie Biodome?
I sure do.
With Pauly Shore and the Christian Baldwin.
And, who else?
It keeps popping up in Artivo because somebody has a Kylie Minogue record wish list.
Auto record.
Yes.
So anytime Kylie Minogue is on television,
whenever Biodome
auto record
or Street Fighter gets rerun, there it is.
Listen. It's important.
I know.
I live in the United States. Not Kylie Minogue Central.
True.
My opportunities to see the most perfect woman be on television are not as frequent.
You have to set that net.
As people in other countries.
You don't want to miss a Graham Norton.
That's right. That's always where she is.
Yes.
She's on Graham Norton like every other week. He just calls her up. It's like,
are you in town?
We had somebody, yeah. Ricky Gervais bailed. Can you come on? She's like, yeah.
Sure.
All right, continue.
Anyway, so Biodome was this dopey 90s comedy.
Yeah.
About, you know, scientists going into this sort of self-contained dome that was supposed to be completely, you know, a closed circuit, if you will, input and output, you know, they were supposed to recirculate all their own air. They were supposed to live entirely within this thing.
Yes.
If you didn't know, Biodome is goofing on an actual real thing that happened.
Yeah.
Which is the Biosphere 2, which was this attempt to sort of predict or kind of anticipate eventual human colonies on the moon or on Mars. And so the idea was
even in an uninhabitable Earth.
Exactly. So, like, how do we create a sort of living, a vivarium for people, you know, where they would be able to grow their own crops, you know, the CO2 would you know, the plants would give off the oxygen, and then the humans would give off the CO2, and there would be an ocean, and there would be a lake, and there would be all these different things, and we're going to live in there for 2 years and close the doors. Very, you know, big shooting, you know, sports metaphor here. What is it? Shooting for the back fences, whatever, hitting for the fences.
Yes.
It's a big, big endeavor. So we find out, like, who's behind this thing? Where do these people come from? And of course, while Biosphere 2 was happening in, was it 1990?
Yeah. Like 91-ish.
We go back to the 60s, of course.
Because it always goes back to some corny hippies.
San Francisco in the
1960s. With a lot of glittery outfits and...
This group of people gets together and it's like...
Living theater.
It's science and street theater, you know? But as you pointed out, like, for hippies, they had a really good work ethic.
They sure did.
They built...
They were not high. They were building things.
They built a boat, like a boat, and they sailed it around the world.
They didn't build a boat first. First, they built a giant geodesic dome
right,
to
in
all
Arizona,
live in New Mexico.
New Mexico, sorry.
To live in as a communal agrarian, you know, cooperative society.
Yeah.
Not a cult.
Yes.
This was communal living,
it was a commune,
self-sufficiency. They did have a charismatic front man.
With... scary eyes.
With scary eyes, sure. But it was not a cult.
No, it was not. First they build the dome and they start the agrarian commune. Then they build the boat. They go around the world. And while they're going around the world, they built a hotel in Kathmandu and they started an art gallery in London. And, you know, so you've got like scientists and architects and theater people and all these sort of combinations of things.
Yeah.
And eventually it all comes down to this idea of creating this, you know, what would become the Biosphere 2. And they got the backing of one of the Bass brothers from the Bass family.
Not Big Mouth Billy Bass.
No. Big Oil.
Big Oil billionaire Ed Bass.
Yes. And, you know, if you were alive then, you remember that all did not go perfectly swimmingly with the Biosphere 2.
Correct.
And I kept expecting this movie was going to be kind of a like a portrait of this wacky fiasco.
Right. I was thinking the same thing because, you know, we just came off of Tiger Beat or whatever.
Tiger King. Yeah. You think it's going to be a sort of Schadenfreude pact, like, oh, look at these nuts. But then it turns out not to be that. Because while, yes, the Biosphere 2 did not deliver everything that they promised, and they did maybe sort of lose sight of, you know, their own publicity and their own hype machine, you know, when they were ostensibly, you know, pursuing science.
Right.
You know, their intentions were good and they did accomplish some things. And they again, it was a big, big endeavor. And they really, there were no half measures certainly going on.
The Biosphere 2 is still a functional part of University of Arizona,
right?
The science people of University of Arizona,
it's educational.
They use it now. Yeah,
you know, and the group is like almost all of them are alive, so they're like almost all interviewed in this documentary.
These are all people in their like 70s and 80s, and the leader is now in his 90s.
Yeah,
yeah.
But you know, they've always taken good care of themselves. So
right.
there's
something to be said for that hippie diet.
I guess so. Yeah. So they have interesting stories to tell. There's a ton of great vintage footage because, you know, not only were they like making theater and geodesic domes, they were filming themselves doing it. So they've got all this stuff for the filmmaker to pull back on. And then, you know, like it is. On the one hand, people have been talking about how it's very much a documentary of the now because it's about people who were, you know, closed in a confined space with a handful of people for a long period of time. So, you know, one can relate. But for me, my ultimate feeling on being done with it was like, I miss, you know, like, not only do I miss sort of the retro-futurism of the post-World War II era, this idea that, like, oh, we're going to be living, you know, on the moon or at the bottom of the sea, and we're all going to have jetpacks, and, you know, that whole sort of, like, you know, really, you know, science will liberate us future right. that never quite came to pass.
Yeah.
And this one is a little more grounded, because like you said, it's not just about, like, colonizing the moon. It's also, what if we completely destroy the planet and we have to, like, you know, take what we can and put it inside these small, you know, living spaces.
Right.
But there's still a sense of optimism and can-doism, I guess, with it. And I don't feel that a lot these days.
No, you know, true.
When we talk about how, like, you know, the last 40 years since Ronald Reagan has been about, like, taking away the big programs and taking away this idea of, like, you know, collectivism and the government sort of spearheading these, you know, visions into the future, and instead making it all about, like, individual stuff in the free market.
Big projects for the common good.
Yeah.
Initiated by the government since the Reagan administration have become less and less likely to get the funding they need, even if they get approved.
Yeah.
You know, we've turned government into business, and it's to the detriment of every citizen in this country.
Yeah, like, how are we going to get a coast-to-coast bullet train when, like, the bridges are all falling apart?
Right, correct.
So, yeah, so this movie at least kind of rekindled this notion of, like, oh, yeah, like, you can have big ideas and do something with them and have them be not just about turning a profit and, like, making money for your execs, but actually improving everybody's existence.
Right.
What did you think?
I think this is a very cool movie. And I was, again, just like you, very happy to see it not be a let's watch as everything falls into chaos. Like, right. I'm not really down for that at this point in my life. Like, while we're here, you know, home, locked down, quarantined,
sheltering in place,
I'm looking for something a little less dispiriting. Mm. And while this was not a full, you know, positive experience for everybody involved, yeah, particularly when Steve Bannon shows up.
Yes, never a good sign.
As the CEO of the company that's sort of like, we're taking it out of your hands now. And he was working with Ed Bass, so it's Ed Bass's fault.
Yeah, Ed Bass got him from, like, Goldman Sachs or something.
Yeah. But so, like, it is ultimately, it'll make you feel good about hippies. Because they tried. They were not, like, you read Slouching Towards Bethlehem, and you're like, oh my God. These people are giving 5-year-olds LSD. This is not good.
Do we think this crew would identify as hippies, though? I mean, I think...
Yeah.
I think they talk about sort of coming from that era and
they
having,
sure did.
Having, like, sharing a lot of the...
But they got out of it. They left.
Yeah.
Like, I think what happened to them is that they went to San Francisco. They found all the hippie stuff that they needed to experience. This was 1967, 68. Right. They were just the right age, prime age baby boomers. You know, they were young adults.
Yeah.
They were doing, you know, they were doing the thing that people were doing in San Francisco at that time. But
then when everybody else became a heroin addict, they built the
boat.
Well,
yeah,
and got
that's where
out
I was going with Slouching Towards Bethlehem. You read Slouching Towards Bethlehem and you're like, oh my God. You know, how did anyone survive this nonsense? And they took themselves out of it.
Yeah.
They were like, well, let's leave and go do a thing that's productive and can maybe, you know, model the kind of world we want to live in.
Right.
And they did. And then they got tired of that, and then they built a boat. They sailed that boat everywhere. Terrifying. There's footage of them launching that boat. I'm like, y'all all gonna drown. Well, where are the life preservers? I absolutely filled me with fear watching that happen.
And then the woman who builds the boat later becomes the architect of the biosphere.
Yeah. So watching the biosphere not function exactly the way they wanted to, it made me feel bad for them, because what happens is, if you are involved in science,
you need to be allowed to fail.
You have to be allowed to fail, because that's part of the process. Yeah. And they weren't allowed to fail. They weren't allowed to have something go wrong and have people say, hey, it's fine, we're going to fix this and figure out a way through it so that we can maybe make it really work, you know, for part two, you know. But, you know, that's not what the news wants to report. The news wants to report, oh, no, they're all starving and suffocating inside this place because the oxygen's running out.
Right. It's weird. Like, you know, on the one hand, you see that there's obviously going to be interest from the media about this thing, and they try to, like, you know, use it to build awareness, but it winds up becoming this thing where it's like they're an expensive movie.
Uh-huh.
You know, and suddenly the story is about, like, oh, it's going to flop. You know, and it's not, you're right. If it were a scientific experiment, it'd be like, well, this worked, this didn't work, but we're making these adjustments or whatever. But it was either like, it was either going to have to be exactly what they promised and more, or else, like, out come the knives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I just, you know, I'm glad this wasn't what I was worried it was going to be.
Mm.
At first I was thinking, do we have to, this thing that went wrong.
Right.
You know, who died? Who wound up in prison? Nobody.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Well, the only person who died was the scientist who thought that you would live to be 120 if you didn't eat much.
Right.
And then he died.
Yeah, but not of not eating.
No, but he didn't, you know.
Yeah.
He got to be like 70-whatever or 80-whatever, and then he
had Lou Gehrig's disease, right?
He had Lou Gehrig's disease, yeah. But even before that, I was like, you might need a little more body fat.
A skosh.
I'm concerned about this.
Speaking of movies that were...
I've got plenty. You can borrow.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. Speaking of movies that were not what I expected they were going to be, the long-shelved musical remake of Valley Girl hit streaming and drive-ins this week.
It sure did.
And it kind of caught us both a little by surprise.
A little bit.
Not to oversell it. We didn't love it, but it was better than I thought it was going to be.
First, let's full disclosure.
Yeah.
We know the screenwriter.
Yes.
Amy Talkington.
Amy Talkington.
And the script is good.
Yeah.
The script is an interesting way to re-present this story.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're going to make a movie in 2020, but well, this was shot in 2017. We'll talk about that in a bit. Mm. If you're going to make a movie in 2020 that is set roughly in 1983, the 80s in general.
Well, as Christy points out, the fact that they watch the launch of Sally Ride and the space shuttle grounds it in time, which she has a point.
What year was Sally Ride and the Space Shuttle?
June of 1983.
Okay. Well, we'll get to the other...
but as you say...
We'll get to the grounding in time in just a moment.
Right.
And the shoot... there are so many things we have to talk about.
Yes.
You're going to represent this story, the framing device of the original Valley Girl herself...
Mm-hmm.
Now middle-aged with her own teenage daughter, telling her teenage daughter the story of Valley Girl, the story of the movie Valley Girl.
Right.
Is kind of adorable because...
And shrewd.
And shrewd because then it becomes a story with a somewhat unreliable narrator.
Exactly.
And they even kind of cop to that.
Early on,
the film opens with a bunch of girls in a mall in the 80s. I'm not going to say 1983 because very much like Take Me Home Tonight.
That was just lazy.
This film plays real fast and loose with 80s cultural signifiers.
Yes.
Some of which happened between the years 1980 and 1983, and some of which happened all the way up until about 1987. And as you're watching it, you're thinking, that was not a thing yet.
That song didn't exist.
Yeah. But not only did that song not exist, but that person dressed up like George Michael in the Choose Life t-shirt who's dancing in the background of a big production number.
So you're about a year early.
It's like 2 years early. And so So all the anachronistic stuff in the film exists in kind of a blender that is part of Alicia Silverstone's memory.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the out that it gives itself that Take Me For Home sure. Tonight does not give itself.
Because the film opens with all these girls in the mall,
yeah,
and they are singing We Got the Beat.
Right.
Which I thought was very clever, because the Go-Go's, perhaps not all of them, but Belinda... explicitly, mm-hmm. Belinda Carlisle was a valley girl who found her way over the hill onto Hollywood Boulevard to the Mask, where she became part of the Germs.
Right.
One of the most notorious punk bands of Los Angeles in the late 1970s. And then formed her own punk band called the Go-Go's.
Yes.
And they used to be on the same stages as the Germs and Black Flag and all these other bands that you would become familiar with, who stayed in the underground while the Go-Go's became mainstream rock and roll stars.
Right. And that song, of course, is also used in the opening credits of Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
No. Which,
isn't it?
Nope. There's a different Go-Go song that's in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, not We Got the Beat.
Oh.
Yeah. So anyway, so I thought that was a very clever thing, because the existence of the song We Got the Beat makes the plot of both the original Valley Girl and this Valley Girl into something of a lie. Because you've got a band that exists whose members are from the San Fernando Valley.
Right.
Who found their way over the big forbidden hill into filthy punk rock Hollywood.
Right.
And then sold themselves across the world as, you know, big, fun, poppy, mainstream rock stars.
Right.
And the story of this movie and the original 1983 Valley Girl is that there's a sheltered, spoiled, but good.
Yes.
Teenage girl who lives in the valley, who falls in love with a punk rock boy from Hollywood. And to go over the hill is sort of a thing that you don't do.
I'm sorry, I must correct you, because I'm looking on the Wikipedia page.
What?
We Got the Beat is the opening theme of Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Is it?
It is.
But there's another song by the Go-Go's on the soundtrack, and that's the one I remember.
There may well be, but it says We Got the Beat by the Go-Go's, which is the movie's opening theme.
Okay, I'm wrong.
Anyway, yes.
Thanks for derailing everything that I was saying here.
The central point of both versions of Valley
well, you
Girl.
Actually, to be there just now.
Look, some listener was already drafting a vicious text, a vicious Google.
Because that's exactly the kind of responses this show gets. Vicious.
Vicious Twitters. Yes, what you're saying, both versions of this story assume the premise in which the Valley and Hollywood are in these bubbles that no one ever leaves.
Never meet. Yeah, like as though people don't have cars.
Exactly.
As though the Beverly Center doesn't exist. These girls like to shop. They were at the Beverly Center, not just Sherman Oaks Galleria.
And Rodeo Drive, for that matter.
And Rodeo Drive, exactly. So, the mall that is dressed in a quasi-80s way, not by any stretch an authentically 80s way.
Yeah, they don't do it as well as Stranger Things, but I'm sure they didn't have nearly the budget either.
Appears to be the Burbank Media Center.
That's what I was thinking,
I don't
too.
Know what mall it really is, but boy, does it look like the Burbank Media Center. And in 2017, it had not yet been
renovated,
and it was a dying mall.
Yeah,
with like empty shops as far as the eye could see.
If you want a mall that looks 80s and that you could afford to like close for a week or whatever to shoot that number,
yeah,
that would be where you'd go.
Yeah. And so I'm fairly confident that that's where that was shot.
Wouldn't be surprised.
I mean, now that it's been renovated, it's still half dying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Poor little mall. Anyway, so what's happening in this opening scene is the girls are singing We Got the Beat.
Right.
And the entire mall is singing We Got the Beat. And the entire mall is dancing to We Got the Beat around a big fountain. It's a production number.
Oh, yeah.
It is choreographed by the choreographer Mandy Moore, who did La La Land and many other things. The Carly Rae Jepsen Lil Yachty Target commercial.
Oh, well.
I might add. Which is a very good Target commercial.
It is.
And so, and you realize immediately that this is not the Valley Girl that you thought it was going to be. Winter Mitchell turned it off in the first 5 minutes.
Yes.
She was so upset by the everything of it. And
this is the kind of thing where if somebody said, hey, we're making a Broadway musical of Valley Girl.
A jukebox musical.
This is what you would get.
All 80s songs, but the story is Valley Girl.
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, like the two big songs from Valley Girl wind up in here. I Melt With You and A Million Miles Away. I was kind of hoping Johnny or You Queer would pop up, but no such luck.
That song out of context is something that people don't quite get anymore.
Not really, no.
Yeah. So the plot beats are exactly the same. Good girl meets bad boy, but he's not bad. He's actually very good. And the good boyfriend that all of her family and friends think is so great is actually a jerk and not good and cruel and mean and shallow and, you know, just because he's tall and blonde and I'm putting the words good looking in quotes because it's, what's
Logan Paul.
Logan Paul. Now, Logan Paul is not an actor. Yep. Logan Paul is a YouTube star.
Yes.
And he's the guy who, while this film was being shot and before this film was shot, was a rising star on YouTube.
It was clearly cast as a way to get young people interested in this property that was, you know, 30 plus years old.
Correct. And then the Logan Paul thing happened where he went to Japan to that forest where people go to kill themselves.
Yeah.
And he, did he find an actual dead person?
Apparently he did.
And then like shot a video of it and made like jokes about it. Like just a complete disaster. This is a human being that, it's not good.
No.
And his
infamy.
Now he's in the film.
Yes. Well, his infamy was enough to like
shelve the movie.
Shelve the movie for years.
Yeah. It was shot in 2017 and then they put it on the shelf.
Yeah.
My understanding is, based on what I've read, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, Amy Talkington, are you listening to this episode? you could tell us what we're right about and what we're wrong about. My understanding is, based on what I've read, that he's the reason they put it on the shelf for a while. They're like, oh, we can't.
Yeah.
It's like
Target on our back.
We don't have the budget to go back and reshoot with Christopher Plummer. We've got, you know, we've got this kid.
Yeah, we're stuck with him.
Let's chop him out of the movie as much as we possibly can.
And the thing is, he's not good.
He's also a terrible actor.
He is the weakest link of this otherwise really charming cast.
That's the worst part. He's also a crap actor.
So it's like, I think the lesson here is don't stunt cast
anyone
because you think it's going to get you some demographic.
Unless you're John Waters putting like Tracy Lords and Debbie Harry and
Pia Zadora.
And Pia Zadora into Hairspray.
Are all three of them in Hairspray?
Well, they're in Hairspray, they're in Crybaby, they're in
something.
Any number of John Waters films.
Right.
Yes.
So anyway, so he's a disaster, but the rest of the movie is you know, again, it ain't great, but it's charming.
Here's what is...
If you have young kids who have no idea about the original Valley Girl, because it was a rated R movie, you know, I think they will be charmed by... They won't mind... They won't either won't know or won't mind that these are cover versions of the songs.
Right.
And they'll just find it, like, fun.
Here is what I think about the package itself.
Okay.
Sweet. Yeah. And charming because of Jessica Roth.
Mainly, yes.
Jessica Roth, you and I have been her cheerleader since Happy Death Day.
Yes.
She's the star of Happy Death Day and Happy Death Day to You.
Yes.
And both films. Delightful,
yes.
Weird, funny, horror thrillers.
Comedies.
That comedies that zigzag all over the place in ways you can never predict. And she sort of marches through both of those films very confidently.
Mm-hmm.
As the most, the final girl with the most agency I've ever seen in a movie. Here, she's playing, 17?
Yeah.
She's 32. She's 32 and she looks 17, which is wild.
Well, but she's 32 now?
Yeah.
Okay, so she was 29 when they shot it then?
You know how much you age between 29 and 32?
Well, I just want to be clear.
Not much.
I just want to be clear here. What we're
She's
talking
a
about.
Grown Andrea Zuckerman
yes. no,
adult.
No, no. She's pulling it off, no question. Even Mae Whitman is pulling it off.
Mae Whitman plays a teenager. She's like almost 30 herself, yeah. Probably. But you believe every single word that comes out of Jessica Roth's mouth
yeah.
in this film. This kind of dopey movie with a premise that doesn't actually make logical sense. You feel her being torn. You feel her wanting to be something that her family doesn't care about, that her friends don't think is interesting,
yeah.
that her friends don't think she should do. Everyone in this movie except her is stuck in an idea of what can a girl grow up to be?
Right.
What should she reasonably expect? And...
Or even aspire to.
And her suffering through that attitude of people around her, she's such a good actress that she makes you feel it.
You know, I think a case could be made that the only reason the original one works is because Deborah Foreman and Nicolas Cage are so
yes.
like engaging.
Yes.
And I would say, yeah, the same is true of Jessica Roth and Josh Whitehouse. I think he's really good too.
I didn't get to say everything I needed to say when we were on KCRW on Friday, mm-hmm. because it's always such a short
yes.
little 60 Not second. Like... it's a 60 second like bit that we do. Because what I was starting to say on KCRW was, you know, the premise is weird. It's based on something that's not true. But what makes the original Valley Girl good, even though it's not a great film, is it has that same sense of restlessness that its character, you know, possesses.
Right.
You know, Deborah Foreman feels the same pull as Jessica Roth's character here. And so in its way, was it Martha Coolidge directed? Mm-hmm. It is a feminist film, and therefore it is important
yeah.
because of what it wants to be, even though it's sort of like a boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets the girl again kind of film. The anachronistic songs here stopped bothering me after about 3 minutes.
Mm.
The sanitized, pristine, extremely clean, extremely scrubbed, you know, candy-colored version of the 1980s that exists here, I also forgave it after a few minutes because all that needs to happen is Alicia Silverstone's daughter saying, wait a second, you were singing and dancing?
In a mall?
In a mall? And Alicia Silverstone is like, yeah, I mean, I think.
That's
like,
how I remember it.
Yeah. And so,
well, you always point out that like the 80s retro movies never get the makeup right.
The makeup on the ladies who are my age, tell me you know what I'm talking about here. I remember the 80s and how heavy that makeup was.
Yeah. Nagel prints existed for a reason.
It was heavy makeup. It was like
oily makeup.
It was oily, yeah. And all you have to do is go look at stuff that was shot back then and see the makeup that they put on.
Go back and watch Modern Girls.
Women, yeah. There is some powerful makeup going on in the 1980s. It's not like this, I'm not really even wearing makeup look. It's like, oh, no, no, we're all wearing makeup. So, you know, unless you go back and you get dead stock makeup from 1982, which would make you look wild. It would make you look like Adam and the Ants.
Well, as you've always pointed out, in Glitter, Mariah Carey is doing the idealized 80s makeup.
Yeah.
And Magnuson is doing the dead-on actual 80s makeup.
Oh, yeah. And Magnuson, who is also from the 80s.
Yes, exactly.
Who remembers.
Having been there.
And Magnuson is the 80s character in a film that is set in the 80s.
Right.
Which makes Glitter even more weird. And necessary. So, yeah, everything here is not the 80s. It's set in the 80s. They keep telling you it's the 80s.
It's the idea.
There's nothing about the 80s going on in this movie. And that's actually fine.
Sure.
Because, again, we've got a narrator who is sort of remembering things being, like, a lot cuter than it really was.
Right.
There are, however, some impeccable costumes.
Mm-hmm.
All of which are worn by Jessica Roth.
Just about.
Like,
yeah.
Everyone else is aiming for Tracy Nelson in Square Pegs, but not really getting it. But but Jessica Roth's costumes are...
Because, yeah, this is
right,
technically...
They're right on point. Yeah.
This is technically the 80s pre-Flashdance.
Well...
Because that's summer of 83.
Yes, but then you have a person at the party... Who's dressed like Jennifer Beals.
Oh, funny.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a big party where there's someone, it's a costume party.
Right.
And there's someone dressed like George Michael. And there's someone dressed like Boy George. And there's someone dressed like Jennifer Beals. And, like, there's someone dressed like every kind of 80s thing you can be, even though they might be things that haven't happened yet.
Yeah.
If indeed this film is meant to be set in 1983.
Right. Life was, what, 85, I guess?
84, 85, something.
Like, if that same person were wearing a shirt that said Frankie Say Relax, however, that would have been more on, you know.
No, that was 84 too.
But that was later. You're right. Yeah. You're right.
Listen.
But this is not the issue here.
I'm old and I remember things. Except that we got the beat open Fast Times Original Night.
I'll tell you, like, I like this movie more than I like Rock of Ages. I liked it more than I like.
Well,
I did.
Rock of Ages has Mary J. Blige.
For 2 minutes.
More than 2 minutes.
She has like one number, and that's about it.
No, she has more than one number.
Anyway, there's not enough Mary J. Blige.
There's never enough Mary J. Blige
to make it as good as it could have been. I liked it better than Rock of Ages. I liked it way better than Jersey Boys.
Jersey Boys is an abomination.
Jukebox musical period pieces. You know, either of the Mamma Mias. So, you know. Yeah, I know you're going to fight me on
part
that.
Part two is a glorious experience.
If you missed our solid hour of discussing that movie, look in our archives.
You can go look at the archive.
So, I mean, I don't want to oversell this thing, but it is, having gone in with very low expectations, I was quite charmed by it.
Yeah, didn't hate it. Yeah. I mean, there are things about it that are weird.
Yes.
But if you aren't, one of the things that Winter said in her tweet where she talked about giving up after a few minutes, where she said the original film is a sacred text. Now, I do not feel it is a sacred text.
No.
I think it is a part of cinema history that is important to know about.
Sure. I love me some Martha Coolidge.
It is a fascinating, you know, film that you would think would have simply been an exploitation film to make some quick money off of the song Valley Girl that was a hit in 1982 from Frank Zappa and his daughter at the time. Well, no, sorry. She's always been his daughter.
Right.
She was 14
I
at
think
the
so,
time.
Yeah. Moon Unit.
Moon Unit Zappa. But it became something other than that.
It's kind of the Lego movie of its day.
Yeah.
In that when you heard it was happening, it was sort of like, whatever. And then it's like, oh, no, they actually bothered to make
a bad movie. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Don't hate this.
Yeah.
I don't hate this.
No, me neither.
And if I felt safe to go out to see a movie at the Mission Tiki Drive-In, which is where it is currently playing in Southern California, we have a drive-in that is functional here that has stayed open through the quarantine.
I think several of them have. Like the Paramount is open and some other ones.
Oh, the Paramount is open too?
I believe so.
I don't like I don't it's like not, the, no, Paramount. The Paramount's like a, it's not a, as good.
It's a reconfigured parking lot.
The Paramount's not as good.
Yeah.
You know, if you want, if you live in Southern California and you want to go to a drive-in and see Valley Girl, it's playing at the Mission Tiki.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what. How are they?
And they're packing them in, apparently. Somebody I know went to see.
But here's my question: how are they operating that concession?
Because
there's that, you get in that concession stand and you're in that long,
yeah, I don't think,
like amusement park line, you zigzag in and out.
I think probably what's happening, I haven't been, so I can't say for sure, but I imagine what they're doing is that the line is outside and people have to be spaced, and then you make your order and they bring it to you.
That's got
to
be the way they do it.
Yeah, there's no way they're packing you into that place. No, of course not. But yeah, they are, you know, they have rules in place about, like, you have to park this far apart, you have to stay in your vehicle.
You said they're packing them in. How do you know this?
Because Chris Willman, a music writer I know from the rap, was talking on Facebook about going to see Valley Girl and that it was, like, really crowded.
Oh, wow, really?
Because that's the only game in many towns.
You know, right. Well, if there's a drive-in. Near you.
I'm saying for Southern California, the only option to go to a movie is to go to the drive-in.
Yeah.
Then he said after watching Valley Girl, he turned his car around and watched How to Build a Girl. I said, well, of the two girls, Valley is my preferred one.
Here's the worst thing about this. You would think, right? You would think that the pedigree involved with How to Build a Girl would mean that that's the good film.
Right. This is the movie we're going to take seriously this week. Yeah, it is.
It's the one with the, you know, ostensibly the one with the important message.
Right. It, Caitlin Moran, who's an acclaimed writer, is adapting her own memoir. It stars Beanie Feldstein doing an Irish accent, so you know she's a serious
Not
actress.
Irish.
She is
Midlands.
Oh, right, sorry, yes.
Midlands.
Yes.
She lives in...
I'm quoting Drea getting it wrong. It was a Midlands accent.
She lives... Wolverhampton?
Yes.
Wolverhampton?
Something with a W. Directed by a woman who has done a gajillion British TV things, but also did a really harrowing film I saw years ago called Stella Does Tricks with Kelly MacDonald. So, I mean, like, it... One would think this would be the movie to watch. And I'm trying to remember at what point was I like, Oh, wait a minute. This is not
it's not
working
good.
The way that it should.
It's not good.
So Beanie Feldstein plays a young woman named Johanna who is nerdy and insecure and quiet and lives a very active fantasy life with, you know, a wall full of her idols. Like, well, does Frida Kahlo ever speak?
I can't remember.
Frida Kahlo's in there. I can't remember if she ever says anything. But, like, she gets advice from, you know, Sigmund Freud and the Bronte sisters and Joe March.
Everybody
and Liz
on
Taylor.
Her wall.
Yes.
All the photos on her wall, they, like you said, they speak to her. Mm-hmm. And they are all played by...
Getting there.
Oh, okay.
They're all played by notable Brits, pretty much. You know, Simon Pegg is Freud, and Alexei Sale is Karl Marx, and the Bronte sisters...
Simon Pegg is not Sigmund Freud. Would you like me to read the list?
Oh, sorry. It's Michael Sheen. I always Michael get those Sheen. Names confused. Sorry. The Bronte sisters are the from Great British Bake Off, right?
Mel and Sue,
yes.
Yeah. Sharon Horgan... Mm-hmm. is on the wall. Gemma Arterton, Lily Allen, Jamila Jamil, so many other people.
And Lily Allen's brother pops up later. We'll get to him in a moment.
Yes.
Anyway, so Johanna's brother, who's gay, which is sort of a plot point, but only,
not much of one.
Only periodically touched on, tells her that a music magazine is having a contest where they're looking for like a teen rock critic.
Yeah.
And Johanna knows pretty much nothing about rock, but she writes them this very, you know, earnest and thought out review of the Annie movie soundtrack.
It is very specifically 1993.
Yes.
In this film. And in 1993, she's so out of touch that she still doesn't know who Happy Mondays are.
Right.
Because he's, the brother's watching them on TV, and she's like, who's this?
Yes.
And though
their father is a musician.
Their father's a sort of failed musician.
Yeah, washed up 1970s guy.
Patty Considine.
Yeah. Anyway, she gets the gig
and
discovers that, like, she has a power in becoming, like, a poison pen critic. And she creates this whole new identity for herself named Dolly Wilde, and she dyes her hair red and starts...
She's extremely mean.
Yes. She starts dressing like a magician, as Drea puts it, like, top hat and these, like, leggings.
Well, she looks like Magenta from Rocky Horror. That's how she's dressed all the time.
She also reminded me of the character Zatanna from DC Comics?
No.
She's a magician, but, like, she can actually make stuff happen by basically saying commands backwards.
Okay.
And it'll, you know, whatever will happen.
Yeah.
So she takes on this whole new persona and becomes larger than life, but of course loses her soul along the way.
Yes.
Mainly by screwing over this one musician guy played by Lily Allen's brother, who...
Alfie Allen. He plays a famous musician.
Yes. And, you know, he's like her first interview, and they immediately hit it off and kind of bond on this whole other level. And so the interview she turns in is all sort of like gushy and fangirlish, and the magazine fires her.
Yeah.
Because that's what you do when you've hired a teenager to be your writer. You don't like edit or like ask for a second draft. You just can them.
Right.
So that's what sort of prompts her to then become like nasty about everything.
Yeah.
And at some point eventually even like taking stuff that he told her off the record and turning it into this whole article where she like...
She betrays him.
She betrays him. She puts him on a blast. She tells all of his secrets and stuff. And then of course, you know, as John Waters would say, she learns.
I wish that her learning was built on something that felt authentic, because nothing here feels authentic.
I was going to say, I wish there was a lot in this movie that doesn't feel authentic.
You know, you forgive Valley Girl for its inauthenticity because it's built in.
Yes.
You know, this is a film that is trying to tell you that, no, I'm a real person who exists in the real world, and here's how the real world operates. But you know for a fact that that's not how the real world operates, because you've lived in the world.
Like, so, Almost Famous isn't a documentary, but it feels like one compared to this.
Yeah.
If we're going to talk about, like, similar milieus and character arcs and whatnot. There's just basic stuff here where you're like, well, that's just a plot contrivance. That's not how this would go down.
Right.
You know?
And I wanted something. Now, let's compare this to Booksmart, because we're talking about Beanie Feldstein.
Okay.
Booksmart doesn't take place in a real world either.
No.
However.
But they tell you that early on.
It's so stylized that you go with it.
Of course.
In the way that you go with... This is an example I use too much because we are big fans, but this is it's a Gilmore Girls scenario.
Yes.
Where, you know, you accept that this is the universe.
Right.
And that's why you believe...
People talk this way.
...in Booksmart. This isn't meant to be a super stylized world. This is meant to be something somewhat authentic, and it's just not. Like, journalism doesn't work this way. Being a teenager doesn't work this way.
And the movie even bakes in like these sort of flights of fancy where she imagines things and you see them manifest, whether it's the talking people on the wall or like she has this vision of like all these boys like showing off for her or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, if the movie were hopping back and forth between like an established reality and what is clearly a fantasy, that's one thing. But this movie just, it does the reality wrong.
In a way... Maybe we are meant to understand that the world bends to her fantasy.
But then
the film doesn't acknowledge that the world is bending to her fantasy.
Exactly.
And so, you know, she becomes the breadwinner of the family as a journalist. And that doesn't happen. Mm. It doesn't even happen when you have two journalists in the family.
As Wallace Shawn says in My Dinner with Andre, playwriting doesn't put salt on the table, much less bread.
It's just a big mess, and I don't take any pleasure in saying this, because I think Beanie Feldstein is so cool and so worthwhile. I was so excited to watch this because of her. because I dig her.
And I like, this is a story I want to
see. I have
not
read this book. And
me
I would,
either.
Now I want to go read the book.
Yeah.
And find out what this,
it's gotta be more,
what happened to this real person.
And apparently, from what I hear, like, she even sort of dialed down some of the real world stuff. Like, in this movie, the character has, is like one of five children in this tiny, like, little council flat kind of duplex. And apparently, in real life, there were eight kids.
Wow.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I want to see a movie about an overly bright young girl who is unappreciated and doesn't know her own strength and, you know, sort of finds this voice and figures out how to make that voice, you know, be true to herself. But this movie just does that so badly.
Wait, it's not a memoir. It's a semi-autobiographical novel, which means anything can happen in the book.
Okay, but that still doesn't excuse, like, not understanding how journalism works. Even if it's a novel. I mean, yeah, it does that sort of winky, like, sort of based on a true story, kinda, in the credits, you know.
Right.
Which I just, I flinch when I see that now.
Yeah.
Like, either tell me it's based on a true story or tell me you made it up, but don't give me that kinda wink.
So,
the movie to absolutely see this
if you're
week.
Curious, I guess maybe go watch it anyway. I don't know. I wish
I could recommend it, but
I wish
I can't. More than anything.
Go watch Beattie Feldstein and Ben Platt sing a Sondheim song in the
there you go,
in the Take Me to the World YouTube
yes
show.
Has Fandango started selling tickets to Merrily We Roll Along yet?
In 20 years, you have a ticket to Merrily We Roll Along, starring 42-year-old Ben Platt and Beanie Feldstein.
Too bad AMC
and also
theaters went
22-year-old Ben Platt and Beanie Feldstein.
No, the movie to see this week, though, is Andrew Ahn's Driveways.
Driveways.
Full disclosure, I kind of know Andrew from
You got to
Outfest.
Know him in an honest way through Outfest. It's
yes.
not like you hang out.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Anyway, this I first saw this movie last fall at the Virginia Film Festival and was already in love with it. And now that in the ensuing months we have lost the great Brian Dennehy, I think that's added even more poignancy to this story. It stars Hong Chau as a woman who is has just inherited her late older sister's house. She and her young son are traveling there to clean it out and, you know, basically turn it over to a realtor, only to discover that the sister from whom she was estranged was a hoarder. So this process is going to take longer than they thought. Lucas J. plays Cody, who is about to turn 9 years old. He winds up befriending the sister's next door neighbor, who played by Dennehy, who is an older war vet. And as you pointed out, I thought really well, this is a movie that is about loneliness.
Now, Hong Chau, you may not know her name yet.
She was on HBO's Watchmen, if you saw that.
She was also in the film
Downsized,
where she stole the show.
Yeah.
As a Vietnamese woman that Matt Damon meets along the way in his quest to become 2 inches tall. And it's a bizarre film, but she's really great in it. This is, as you said that I said, because I did say it, this is a film about loneliness.
Yeah.
And it's a film about finding people to love in your loneliness.
Yeah.
Now, if you listen to the premise and you hear the words crusty old man and, you know, charming little boy, and you immediately think, nope, then you are me. Because I heard this premise and my first thought was, I'm not watching this. I refuse to subject myself to another, you know, adorable kid who wins over the cranky old man. I've seen it 1,000 times, and I'm no longer available for that. That's not what happens here.
No.
immediately Brian Dennehy's character is sort of open to the kid and the mom. There's no conflict between them. They don't have to overcome any disagreements or weirdness or, you know, old white man racism or anything. Because you immediately think that's what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And
he's wearing a Korean War veteran.
He was in the Korean War. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're Vietnamese.
And so the so all of that is already off the table. The film has a whole other agenda.
Right.
And that agenda is kind human decency.
Yes.
There is not a faster way to make me cry. I do not cry when a film is happening. I do not cry in a film when terrible things happen to people, when great tragedy befalls people. I cry when people are especially good to each other, when they are acting with like
their best selves,
their best, most loving selves.
Yeah. The ending of It's a Wonderful Life.
The ending of It's a Wonderful Life, but the middle of It's a Wonderful Life, when I've said this recently, and I don't remember where I said it or what podcast I was on when I said it, but the moment Donna Reed walks into the bank holding the $2,000 that they were going to spend on their honeymoon, and there's a bank run going on and everyone's panicking, and she walks in the bank and waves the money in the air and says, "How much do you need?" I almost burst into tears every time that happens, because it is this—it's this act of insane selflessness.
Yeah,
you know, and the ending when everyone else is giving back to them the way that they have been given to,
is
always. And I've seen that movie 40 times, and it chokes me up every time. This is a film about people caring for each other in very slow, quiet, gentle ways. It's about a lonely little boy who doesn't fit in well with the other boys. The boys who want to wrestle on the ground and be violent and mean to each other.
Mm-hmm.
He would rather go to the VFW and play bingo with the old man.
And have the soup.
He'd rather, you get to the VFW and they're like, "Do you want a hot dog? Do you want a, how would you like, we have some soup." And the kid's like, "I would like the soup, please." Like, he's an odd kid. But, you know, who among us weren't? who wasn't an odd child?
Exactly.
I certainly was. Mm. And watching these three actors work with each other and bring out the goodness in these characters.
Yeah.
In the most humane, not treacly, not saccharine, not overly sweet, not manipulative. It is a perfectly balanced, serious drama about goodness.
Yeah.
And I love it so much.
It's so great. I mean, I
can't imagine the year coming to an end and it not being, you know, a film that I keep pushing and urging on people.
Absolutely.
It's one of the best things I've seen so far this year.
Yeah, no question. Andrew Ahn's first film, Spawn Night, was really lovely, but it's about a character who is so emotionally repressed because he is so deeply in the closet.
Yeah.
That, like, it's a great performance from the lead actor, but so much is about, like, what is being hidden and what he's sort of, the sort of flashes of realization about things. Whereas this is a movie that is about people who are pretty openly, like, you know, they're not really holding anything back, but they're just, you know, it's a sort of a, they're all kind of wounded by life in one way or other. And are,
yeah, because they all talk about estrangement. They talk about regret, disappointment, and yet they are still here trying to make something good happen in their lives.
You know, it's funny. I said earlier that Hong Chao and her son were Vietnamese, and I don't actually know. She is, and that was, you know. But there's a scene in the film where another neighbor, played by Christine Ebersole, says, "So, where are you from?" And she says, "Michigan."
Michigan. Yeah, the racism comes in with Christine Ebersole.
But never overtly. Like she never follows it up with, well, where are you really from? She knows not to ask that follow up.
We'll just shorthand it and call it the Karen. She's the Karen of the movie.
Yeah. Anyway, it's lovely and you really should see it.
It's really beautiful. It's streaming right now.
It is.
It would normally be in movie theaters.
It would.
But it's streaming. You really, like, I know this is a really gross moment in history.
Yes.
And this is a terrible 2020. And you don't want maybe anything heavy or that will make you feel sad. This is not that film.
No, this will make you feel good about...
You'll cry, but...
humanity.
But it's a film that is about the best of what human beings can be for each other.
Yes.
I cannot recommend it highly enough.
Ditto. So our DVD pick this week is actually a DVD label. Twilight Time Video.
Yeah.
Put out really amazing Blu-rays over the years. Digging mostly into, I think, the Fox catalog was where a lot of this came from. And so, sadly, one of the founders has passed away, and of course now the Fox catalog is being controlled by Disney, so apparently those two factors were enough for them to decide, we're done. So they are going out of business, but they are currently...
Which is a bummer, because they would put out really cool stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
Limited edition quantities.
Yeah, you had to kind of...
You had to kind of get it and go, you know...
Yeah.
You had to be there for the release, and then... Yeah.
Get your order in early. So anyway, they are offering a...
drastic markdown.
Yes. Big sale, big going out of business sale, basically. So if you go to twilighttimemovies.com, you know, just take an amble through there. You're going to find all kinds of stuff, all kinds of genres, all kinds of
eras. We are not
eras.
Connected to them in any way.
Yeah, this isn't an ad.
This is us being enthusiastic.
Exactly. We're fans. So, you know, like, I'm snapping up a copy of, Two for the Road, which is one of my favorite movies. They have, The Gang's All Here, which is a musical.
A Journey to the Stars.
a Carmen Miranda classic. So yeah, a lot of different things. So whatever kind of films you're into, I've always been a supporter of physical media. There was an article this week about Amazon getting sued because people who thought they were buying a movie when they said you're buying a movie and then having it taken away because they can just do that.
Oh, is that so?
Oh, yeah. In the fine print.
Jeff Bezos is the coolest guy.
Uh-huh. He's going to save us all. Yeah, I'm a big proponent of owning things physically so that you can have them forever. Go to the Twilight Time website, check out their sale, and, you know, snap up some of your favorite movies because we passed this way but once.
Way to make it dark. There.
You know what I mean.
Do I? Hey, we got some letters.
We do.
I'm going to read them to you. This is from John. I've been a fan for a couple of years now. I'm always very happy when the two of you appear in my feed to keep me up to date on all the big films that I've seen. And entice me with the small films my quiet backwater of the UK does not get to see. It has, however, been on my mind that one of the finest films of last year has seemingly been snubbed by the two of you. What?
What?
What have we snubbed? Since I try to make it to the cinema to see as many films as my night shift will allow, typically two, but I will occasionally push it to four.
Wow.
Oof. I have normally seen the blockbusters before I hear you. At the start of the week. So at first, I thought little of you not mentioning, sorry we missed you. Oh! Wait, when was this? Oh, you wrote this in April.
Yeah.
Well, wait, didn't we already talk about sorry?
Well, maybe keep going. Maybe he acknowledges that we did.
Then time passed, and that seemed understandable. After all, how big is the market for social commentary about the working class in the north of England amongst U.S. audiences? Even when it comes from a legend like Ken Loach. Anyhow, as the two of you started to... Started to fill B ears butterscotch. What? This sentence makes no sense. I was thinking to myself that I should drop you a line to encourage you in the direction of a film that I thought was great. These thoughts usually pass. After all, what does my opinion really matter in the grand scheme of things? John!
Come on.
Your opinion matters.
Of course.
Unless it's wrong.
Well, yeah.
But imagine my delight when you started discussing the film. Well, yes. It opened in the United States, finally.
Yes.
I assume it opened in the UK much earlier
like
than
the
in the
end
US.
Of last year. Yeah, we didn't get it yet.
So many thanks for all your good works and getting to this most deserving of films, if a little late from a UK perspective. Hopefully you'll keep an eye out for the latest from Michael Winterbottom and Steve Coogan, Greed. Now, that already opened here,
yeah,
but,
that
we, kinda, but we missed
that
it.
That came and went, and we missed it.
So we catch up on it. Based pretty much entirely on Sir Philip Greene and the fourth season film, The Trip to Greece. I cannot wait.
Oh, yes. Very excited about that.
Those the trip movies with Steve Coogan and
Rob Brydon.
I laugh until I'm hyperventilating.
They just did a little... Yeah. The two of them just did a clip for like...
some comic relief
comic
kind of
relief
thing
that was...
The whole thing is they're just mocking Richard Curtis,
well,
which is good.
Yes, always. Yeah. They talk about how, like, with society falling apart, that, like, you know, it's going to be rich celebrities becoming feudal lords.
Yes.
And they do this whole thing about Mick Jagger talking about crop rotation that just cracked me up.
It has some important information about high street capitalism and will not leave you as depressed as sorry we missed you. Nothing will leave you as depressed as sorry we missed you. Another great film.
Yes. But who?
That will bum you the F out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was the second last film I saw before lockdown. I followed it up with Bloodshoot. Bloodshoot or Bloodshot?
Bloodshot.
Okay. Which was exactly what I expected. This short thank you does seem to be running the risk of rambling, so I will reserve my thoughts on The Gentleman and Rhythm Section for my own personal enjoyment. Blake Lively eats oatmeal. Kinda. Keep up the good work. Take care, John. Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
Cody says, I never had HBO growing up. My family could not afford it. Instead, I fell in love with Clue from being shown on TBS or FX or another movie channel often, as well as renting it numerous times from Blockbuster.
Interesting, yes.
When did your family get HBO?
I remember this. We didn't have HBO. We could pick one, and we thought, oh, well, let's get the movie channel because we want this for movies.
Yeah.
So, which was maybe a mistake, because I think HBO probably had better movies, but we had the movie channel. We got it, I want to say, in, I think, the fall of 1982, because I distinctly remember my mom making a deal with me that if I went to this, like, church weekend youth retreat thing, that we could get cable. I'm like, oh, fine. I did not want to go.
The whole time you're thinking, HBO, 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 HBO,
movie channel. So yeah, I was 15. When did you get cable?
Well, my family could also not afford cable or pay cable, but they had it anyway because they were terrible with money. So,
did they take food out of your mouth
get HBO? My mother and stepfather. My mom was very... I promise this is not going to be a bummer. My stepdad would get his check and just go spend it all on beer. Sure.
As you do.
My mom, though, worked two jobs to make up for the fact that my stepfather spent it all on beer. But my stepfather still had a say in what the money got spent on.
Aye.
So he'd be like, well, we're gonna have cable and we're gonna have HBO, and you know, when you're a kid, you're like, okay, great. You know, we can't afford important things, but we've got HBO. Okay, listen, whatever makes me happy.
So when was this?
I'll just deal with this. This was 1981. This was early.
Yeah.
My dad was the same way. My dad was just like a manager of a steakhouse, but he had HBO in his apartment.
Hmm.
So, and this was 1979.
Yeah,
I remember. I would just go to my dad's apartment and be like, okay, I'm here to... we don't have to have a conversation. I'm here to watch a series of films in a row. Then we could go to Pizza Hut and we'll come back and I'll watch more movies.
That's how I was. My parents had a condo in Florida.
Yeah.
And I guess everybody in the building had, there was some sort of like closed circuit where you got your TV from the building antenna or whatever. Yeah. And it had HBO on it before my neighborhood at home even had the option of cable.
Yeah.
So it was very exciting.
Yeah. So weirdly enough, even though my family was like always on the brink of financial ruin, we always had cable. We always had HBO.
But anyway, yeah, so people discovered Clue a lot of ways that were outside of the theatrical experience. I didn't mean to just say there was HBO.
Right. Kat says, Golden Years is a heist movie of the Let's Rob the Bank That Screwed Us Over school, and it's called Golden Years because they're all senior citizens. What movie are we talking about here?
I guess maybe it was on somebody's list, on Vera's, perhaps.
Okay, got it.
All right. Kat's in the UK, so it's a
movie yes.
That we
Yes, that is true. That is correct. Justin. Hello, fellas. Justin from New Jersey here. Dropping a line to say that I recently just visited Paul Haggis's Crash. Just revisited Paul Haggis's Crash. Why?
Are you doing a completist run through all the Best Picture winners or something?
Now, I'm not speaking in hyperbole when I say that I think this movie is genuinely an awful piece of art. Note the capital A in awful. At its best, it's an example of poor filmmaking, and I think that it's the worst movie to ever win Best Picture. It makes Green Book look like Moonlight.
Oof.
I agree.
I'd have to go back and sit through The Greatest Show on Earth again, but it's definitely like bottom three.
Yeah. But that's beside the point. One of my favorite things about watching a film is then having those imaginary conversations with film critics like yourselves, most commonly via the podcast medium. I consider you two close friends by this point. I can practically smell that banana bread in the oven. Oh, dude, Justin, don't say banana bread. I ruined. Okay. I ordered Nutella online because we couldn't find it.
And vanilla pudding.
No. Two different recipes.
Oh, okay.
I ordered the vanilla pudding online because I wanted to make Chrissy Teigen's banana bread recipe.
I see.
I ordered the Nutella because I wanted to make the New York Times Nutella banana bread recipe.
Gotcha.
And the grocery store is such an unreliable place these days, you can't get the Jell-O vanilla pudding that you would never use in any other reason other than to make Chrissy Teigen's banana bread. And Nutella is like, you know, that's only the dried beans that no one wants are still on the shelves. It's
the
open season on Nutella around here. Anyway, I get the Nutella. I'm like, yay, I'm going to make the Nutella banana bread. I go to the refrigerator where I've got the bananas and they have turned black, which is exactly what you want for banana bread. You want them to be preserved and mushy inside with the black peel. But they stayed black one too many days. And they weren't cool and mushy on the inside anymore. They were dying on the inside. They were weird. They were this weird gray color and they were all like bruised and just everything was a mess. And I thought, well, I guess I have to eat this Nutella out of the jar with my fingers.
As they say in game show.
So now I have to go get another batch of bananas. Reserve three or four of them, let them turn brown and browner and brownest.
Pitch black.
And then get that banana bread in the oven. But I had to throw out four entire bananas the other day, and I felt horrible about it, because there is nothing I hate worse than wasting food, wasting anything.
Right. Well, you meant well.
I'm going to continue with this letter now.
Okay. Don't mention the banana bread to Dave.
He continues, but I'm also a firm believer and patron of print as well. I always type the recently watched movie title into RogerEbert.com to see what the most venerated film critic of all time thought on the matter. He had Crash as his number one movie of that year, which is fine. The film racked in numerous prestigious awards, including a Best Picture win. It currently holds a 74% fresh rating on the tomato meter with an 88% audience score. As baffled as I am by these numbers, I'm not ignorant to the fact that I'm in the minority here. Even so, what shocked me most was to see the Regal Roger engage in a virtual bickering match with readers and other critics. In his article, in defense of the year's, in quotes, worst movie, I noticed a couple of names pop up, like Scott Foundas, Jim Emerson, and the one I could not help to take note of, D. Leland White. Well, Justin, I was there, and I know what you're talking about. But we'll continue with the letter. I couldn't find your full review anywhere. I think it was for MSNBC at the time. But Ebert nevertheless took a snippet from it to use you as an example. Okay, so here's what happened. At the time, I was writing for Movies.com. My reviews are gone from Movies.com at this point. I archived them myself. I have all of them here in my laptop and in the hard drive. MSNBC at the time was an outlet that I was also writing for. This was back when websites hired people to write things and paid them money.
Imagine.
And I did it. And they asked me to write my worst movies of the year list because they knew that I would be mean.
That was when you wrote Awful is the New Awesome, right?
That was what I called it Awful is the New Awesome. Anyway. Here's a quote from the piece. Justin is quoting me from this
Ebert piece.
Yeah. Kids, racism is really, really, really bad and wrong. Look, just watch this heavy, important movie about how everyone who lives in Los Angeles, all 12 of them, is super racist and awful. It's really funny when Hollywood decides to tackle a serious moral issue and throw star power and weight behind something that everyone but neo-Nazis agree on already. Justin continues, I'm certainly on your side with this one. The film plays like an ostentatious high schooler who somehow convinced the principal to produce a play about racism because it's important. It didn't stop there, though. There were several more articles included on Ebert's website and even an interesting rebuttal by Scott Foundas in the LA Weekly. I don't watch reality television, so I don't get scooped up in these reunion shows where angry people scream at each other before bashing their heads in with a champagne bottle, but this whole thread of film criticism fascinated me. So my questions to you are, where can I read your full review of Crash? I'd have to go find it. I'd have to go dig it out, print it up. Yeah. And I can try to locate it.
I mean, you know, I know Google Cache
maybe
is a thing. Maybe you can.
I'll tell you something though. Here's the thing: at the time of Crash's release, I was not really writing proper reviews.
Oh, that's true. Those are your shorter.
I was hired by Movies.com by one of my editors from another website, who wanted me to be less film critic and more dude having fun.
Mm.
And so, to that end, I was given a format of bullet point topics. And I made up the names of the bullet points, and they're always goofy stuff. Every bullet point was meant to end with a sort of a punchy, funny thing. And sometimes I succeeded, and sometimes I failed.
At that point, like, all of your reviews included when to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, it was not film criticism. It was just fun writing about movies.
Sure.
I was having fun. There was no reason anyone should call me a film critic in that era. Okay. I think I became one later.
Yeah.
But anyway. I could try to dig up my review.
All right.
Do you still view the film the same way you did 15 years ago? Yes.
Yes.
It sucks. It is a terrible movie. Is this Betty Davis-Joan Crawford-esque feud something that you remember vividly? Is it something still gossiped about through all the L.A. coffee shops? Well, I'm going to tell you something, Justin, about...
I went into a hipster coffee shop, and here's what I heard.
I'll tell you something, Justin, about me. I'm nobody. And when I say that, I'm not just being self-deprecating. I mean that in the world of film criticism, I've known serious film critics for 20 years who won't even look at me or remember my name or say hello to me at a press screening. If they see me with Alonzo, They will chat with Alonzo and ignore me. I'm not making this up. This is real.
It is.
And so when you say this is a Joan Crawford, Betty Davis kind of feud, that would imply that I'm on equal footing with Roger Ebert then or now, and I have never been. I think of myself as a nice film critic who does reasonably good work sometimes. But I'm not considered important. I'm not asked to be on juries like Alonzo Duralde. I'm not asked to come in and do DVD commentaries like Alonzo Duralde. Or go to film festivals in Italy like Alonzo Duralde. No. I'm telling, listen, we live in a house of unbalanced, you know, authority here. You're the scholar that people ask about first, and I'm your sidekick. And that's the reality of it, and I don't have any problem with this at all. I am happy to be at home making dinner and contributing to this podcast and writing film reviews for The Wrap and previously for Movies.com and for anyone who else who wants to hire me to do it. I think I'm not bad at my job. I have no bad feelings about myself as a film critic. I think I'm as film critic-y a film critic as any film critic out there, including the ones who live here and work for big outlets and who ignore me and never learn my name.
Well, if they were really paying attention, they would know that you're the real powerhouse coming out of this apartment.
Sure. You can say that to me all day, and it makes me feel all tingly and lovey inside for you. But let's talk about the real world for a moment. Let's just keep talking about the real world for a moment. In the real world, I ain't ish, all right? So, Roger Ebert dunked me in his article. And here's what happened. I read it, and my first thought was, ooh, Roger Ebert put my name in a column! He hates me. He says I'm glib. And let's be real. I was glib. Fully, he's correct. I was glib. I was so excited that he wrote my name in print. It didn't make me feel one negative thing about Roger Ebert. I still thought he was cool and great. And then it was over. Because no one cared. Because he wound up having a real fight with Scott Foundas. Like, they went back and forth.
Right.
And I was just like, woohoo! Roger Ebert said my name! Like, I didn't
This
care.
Was before there was film Twitter.
Yeah. There was no film Twitter at the time. I just did not care. I was happy. And he didn't convince me that I was wrong, because of course I wasn't wrong. I was right. Roger Ebert was wrong about Crash.
Yes.
Roger Ebert was not always right. So yeah,
Speed 2.
There was no, this was not a feud. This was him calling me out, calling me glib, and me being unusually happy about it.
You were on his radar. It was exciting.
Like, oh, someone, a well-known film critic
is dragging me.
found out that I'm an actual person. Oh, I could name names right now.
Look, I think a lot of that stuff has to do with venue, and at the moment, I don't have one, so
right,
we're on equal footing.
Yeah, sure we are. All right. What does Alonzo think about Crash?
Oh, it's terrible.
It's terrible.
Dave and I went to see that movie, and we made it a point to not sit near anybody, but we still decided that we didn't want to be the people chortling we didn't want to yuck anybody's yum with that, so we just punched each other in the leg every time something funny happened, and I think we both left with bruises.
I'm looking up what films were nominated for Best Picture that year.
Oh, well, I know one of them.
Brokeback Mountain. Hang on.
Okay.
I'm sorry. The
Was there a Lord of the Rings in there?
Oh, golly. Here, why don't you pause it while I figure this out here. Okay, thank you. I just pulled it up.
Okay.
The Best Picture nominees for that year were Crash, which won.
Yes.
Brokeback Mountain. Capote.
Oh, yeah.
Good Night and Good Luck.
Mm-hmm.
And Munich.
Hmm.
Those were the films that were nominated. Now, the final question is, I don't dig too deeply into award season, but where did you stand on that year's Academy Awards? I'm assuming, because of your sexual orientation, that your rooting interests were probably in favor of Brokeback Mountain. Oh no, did I just turn you two into a stereotype? Maybe Crash is good after all. You did just turn us into a stereotype, but it's fine.
Brokeback Mountain happens to be a great movie that also happens to be a gay movie.
I think Brokeback Mountain is a very good film and is the equal of Good Night and Good Luck, of Munich, which I think are also good films.
Mm-hmm.
Crash is terrible. What was the other?
Capote.
Capote, I kind of barely remember.
I've actually
Capote,
never...
even though I think Philip Seymour Hoffman was great,
yeah.
And then that was the year that Catherine Keener came to the Los Angeles Film Critics Awards and just made my night.
I've still never seen Munich, actually.
Oh, you never seen Munich?
I never did. But no, I think Brokeback Mountain was clearly a superior film, and Kenneth Turan, I thought, wrote a really great post-mortem about that year's Oscars, where he basically said that for older Hollywood types who didn't feel comfortable voting for Brokeback Mountain, but still wanted to look, you know, committed to progressive social issues,
right,
they could vote for Crash and be like, oh, well, yes, that's the anti-racism movie.
Right, right. Yeah, because there were people in the Academy who refused to even watch Brokeback
Mountain. Oh, yeah, and would say so.
Yeah.
Ernest Borgnine, Tony Curtis.
Ernie, why? Mm. Why? 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 I loved you.
He never saw you do the My Linda monologue.
That would have turned him. He would have said, that gay
is all right.
Is all right. I'm going to watch this homosexual film.
Yeah. Thanks for nothing, Borgnine.
Preacher!
My Linda.
You took from me the only thing I ever loved in the whole world. My Linda. You killed her. And then he says, you killed her four more times.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, thank you. Thank you, Justin.
Yes.
Yeah, there was no, listen.
For that walk down memory lane.
There was never anything regard. There was never a feud. There was a very powerful journalist who called me a name. And I thought it was cool.
You were just happy to get the publicity.
Yeah. There's no bad publicity.
The only thing worse than being talked about.
So, yeah, okay, we're done.
Yes.
Why don't you, hey, we have a Patreon.
We do.
It's called patreon.com/linoleumknife. If you go to it.
There's so many things.
There are options. There are subscription levels from $1 to $20 per month. Although I don't think anyone is allowed to be at the $20 level right now.
I think we're full up.
Because we're full. That's the only one where we have a limit.
Yeah.
And everything else is open. At every level, you get things. You get different podcasts. You get items if you like them. You get
recommendations.
Recommendations, daily cultural recommendations. You get all kinds of stuff. Go
online
to Patreon,
club meetings.
patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Yes.
And you'll find out everything you need to know. We're going to update the page this week to give you new information.
Things have changed. But even at a dollar, you're getting quite a few things.
We said we were going to update the page like a while ago, but then, you know,
life happened.
World went to hell. Yeah,
we'll get there.
Yeah.
But yes, do please check that out. And do please check out all of our friends on the internet. Go over to Critically Acclaimed Network. Hear what Bibbs and Whitney are up to on multiple shows. Check out The Schmoes Know and Anyone with Dennis Hensley. The Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, All Things Cozy, Deck the Hallmark. Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Secretly Timid, Big Fat Gay Podcast. You can subscribe to this show for free on Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. We will read it on the air. It's been a while since we've gotten one, so please go do that. It does help people find the show. Yeah. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places where this show streams, like Spotify and Stitcher Radio and Google Play and CastBox and Podbean. You can follow us on social media at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with any questions or comments. You know, thanks for spending some more time with us this week. We hope you're hanging in there, and we'll be back next time with more. Until then,
goodbye.